Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls because right now we have on the line with us Bill Federer, and now today is Columbus Day. This program will be rebroadcast in a couple of weeks, but for those of you who are listening today, we're having Bill on today because he's going to be talking about Christopher Columbus, a name that was once known and honored here in the United States, but as time has gone by, there's been an organized effort to demonize Christopher Columbus is a bad white guy, an evil white guy who came over here to exploit the natives and steal their gold. But let's go a little bit into the real history of Christopher Columbus, not going into the modified, the alternative views put forward by those who would discredit Christopher Columbus and discredit the founding fathers of America and discredit everything about America because they hate America and they're doing everything they can to destroy belief in this country. And, of course, to encourage belief. And the fact that we need to be planetary citizens of the New World Order. Well, that is the background, Bill Federer. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Bill.
Oh, Stan, it's always a pleasure.
Why don't you just get started there, and we'll just sort of listen. And I always enjoy you telling the story of Christopher Columbus.
Well, one of the fascinating things is that when you look at what happened that brought about his journey. In other words, in 621 A.D. is when Muhammad rode into Medina with his army and killed a bunch of people and basically started his religion of Islam. The word Islam means submission, and a Muslim is somebody who has submitted. And so they went from town to town and village to village saying, submit or die, and those that did not submit died. Those that did submit, he'd say, get your sword and your horse, follow me to the next town. And there were 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th century, and back then, this is before the Reformation, all the Christians were Catholic, but within just a short amount of time, 100 years or less, all of them were wiped out by the Muslims. The Muslims came up through Spain, they came up through Palestine, all of Palestine was Byzantine Christian. That's where the church started, for heaven's sakes, and it had been weakened through a war with Persia, and the Muslims swept in there, and in 636 A.D., the Bishop of Jerusalem stood on the walls and after a four-month bloody siege surrendered Jerusalem to the Muslims. And then all seven churches mentioned in the Book of Revelation were in Asia Minor. And, the church at Philadelphia and the church at Laodicea and so forth, they were all wiped out by the Muslims. Finally, in 1452, the Muslims finally conquered Constantinople and turned it into Istanbul. And this was pivotal because this finally cut off the trade routes from Western Europe to India and China, you know, where they took the China Silk Road and so forth. Anyway, the Western Europeans were trying to find another way to get to India and China. The King of Portugal, Henry the Navigator, sent ships around South Africa. And in 1499, the first ship returned. Took 16 months' journey. But before that happened is when 1492 is when Ferdinand and Isabel of Spain drove the Muslims out of Spain, and they finally agreed to Columbus's idea to get to India and China by going west. And so in a sense, if Islam was a peaceful religion, Columbus would have never set sail, and America would have never been found.
We'll be back in just a moment with William Federer as we talk about Columbus and the real significance. Well, go ahead there, Bill.
Well, and another interesting thing was Marco Polo. Now, Marco Polo's dad, Niccolo, and his uncle traveled to China in 1265, a long time ago. And China was ruled by Kublai Khan. He was the grandson of Genghis Khan. And Kublai Khan's empire stretched all the way from Korea and China to Persia and India to Hungary and Russia. I mean, it was huge. And when the Kublai Khan took Niccolo and Matteo Polo into his court, he was so impressed with these Latins and with what they said about their Christian religion and so forth, that he asked that they return with 100 missionaries, 100 teachers of the Christian faith, along with oil from the lamp at the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. So when the Polo brothers went back to Italy and requested that of Pope Clement the Fourth, but he died shortly thereafter, so they waited till the next pope, Pope Gregory, and instead of getting 100 teachers, all they got were 2 preaching friars. And as they set off again, this time they took Niccolo's son Marco Polo, and he was only 15 years old. And when they were going through Armenia and then off Afghanistan, they were fell amongst some warring tribes, and the 2 preaching friars left. They got scared and left. Anyway, Marco Polo, along with his dad and uncle, continued to China again. It was a several-year journey. When they finally got there, Kublai Khan was so thrilled to see them, and he did get the gifts from the Pope. And again, this is the 12th century, it's before the Reformation. And Kublai Khan employed them as envoys, as, you know, administrative assistants in his kingdom for the next 24 years. They were treated as royalty, and Kublai Khan trusted them explicitly. He begged them to stay, but after that a long amount of time, they decided that they wanted to go back, and he gave them permission. When they got back to Italy, to Venice, Venice was at war with Genoa. And so Marco Polo was on a ship that was taken captive at Genoa, and he spent a year in prison there in Genoa, and Marco Polo dictated the story of his travels to a novel writer, and he wrote them down, and that spread all across Europe. Well, now, that was in 1296. Well, Columbus was born 150 years later in Genoa. So he was intimately aware of these stories of Marco Polo. And so in Columbus's letter to the King and Queen of Spain in 1492, he says this. He says, concerning the lands of India...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Bill. We're going to bring other stations on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Federer, and we're talking really about Columbus, but giving the background of all this, how this came about. And Bill was just commenting that the Polo brothers had gone to China, and of course, on their second trip to China, why they took with them the son of one of the Polo brothers. His name was Marco. And so this is Marco Polo, who is really rather famous. This is in the 1200s, and they were well received in China. The Chinese emperor was certainly fascinated with the Christian story and what the Christians had to offer. And so, you know, 150 years or so later, why, of course, Christopher Columbus is born. And here, here's these stories of Marco Polo and, of course, their adventures in China. And he then begins to write to the ruling monarch there in Spain, asking for their help so he can launch an expedition to go westward to reach, of course, the area that Marco Polo had going eastward. So with this idea, the earth was actually round, and they were going to, by sailing far enough westward, they would eventually get to China. So pick up the story there, Bill.
As a matter of fact, Christopher Columbus's copy of Marco Polo's travels was so well-worn. Everybody that, you know, had read about it, knew Columbus carried this thing around, practically had it memorized. Well, he writes to the King and Queen of Spain in 1492, and Columbus says, concerning the lands of India and of a prince who is called Grand Khan, like Kublai Khan or Genghis Khan, Grand Khan, how many times he and his predecessor had sent to Rome to seek doctors in our holy faith to instruct them therein, and that never had the Holy Father provided them, and thus so many people were lost through idolatry. Your Highnesses, devoted to the Christian faith, resolved to send me to said regions of India to see the said prince and the manner in which may be undertaken their conversion to our holy faith. And so Columbus, he thought he was going to India, and he writes this. This is October 10th in 1492. 2 days before he sighted land, Columbus's journal records, he said, "Here the people could stand it no longer and complained of the long voyage. But the admiral cheered them as best he could. He added that it was useless to complain. He had come to the Indies and so had to continue until he found them with the help of our Lord." And so he thought he was going to preach the gospel to the Grand Khan of China and India, and little did he know that he was only halfway around the world instead of all the way. When he left, he did have the longest voyage ever out of the sight of land. So Columbus was probably the best dead reckoning sailor. He was born in Genoa, Italy, and his parents were wool merchants. He joined the Portuguese and served in their navy. Actually, at one point, he was on a ship that was attacked, and the Portuguese ship sank, and Columbus floated ashore on an oar when he was there in Lisbon. And Lisbon was in its golden age. It was the biggest, most... that's where all the discoveries were being made around the world, was through Portugal. Henry the Navigator was the king, and he actually opened a school of navigation there. And the Portuguese were traveling all up the eastern coast of Europe to Ireland, to Greenland and Iceland, and then they were traveling down to Guinea. They had quite a bit of exploration and colonizing going on in North Africa. And so the Portuguese were the up and coming. They were the Dell and the Microsoft computer. That was, you know, the map making was the high tech industry. And so Columbus and his brother, Bartholomew, start a map making business. And they were aware of the stories of St. Brendan, who was an Irish monk who traveled the ocean and talked about a land beyond the, you know, the ocean. They heard the stories of Leif Erikson. Columbus got married to a Portuguese royalty, a girl whose father, who had passed away by the time of the marriage, but the father was the governor of the Azores, of one of the islands in the Azores. Now, the Azores were discovered by the Portuguese earlier in the 1400s, and they're a third of the way across the Atlantic. So, you know, if you look on a map, the Azores are, you know, almost halfway across the Atlantic in and of itself. Well, one story of Alonso de Cueva, who was a Portuguese sailor, who was blown off course 28 days to the west in a big, terrible storm, and he and his men limped back, and almost all of his men died before they reached the Azores to the island of Madeira. That's where the Madeira wine is, but Columbus lived there with his bride. And he told them of this land that was 28 days to the west, and unfortunately he died, but Columbus had a son that was born there, Diego, and unfortunately his wife died. After that, Columbus went back to Portugal, tried to get the king of Portugal to finance his trip, but the king of Portugal had wasted so much money to try to colonize North Africa and to try to reach India by going south that he basically couldn't see the financial aim to it, and so he sent his brother to England to try to get them, because they had financed John Cabot try to find a way across. And so finally Columbus went to Spain, and after 7 years he had the King and Queen of Spain finally agree to finance his trip. And he writes, between his third and fourth voyage, Columbus wrote his Libro de las Profecias, Book of the Prophecies. And what he did is he went through, in every verse in the Bible that talked about taking the gospel to the ends of the sea, to the isles yet unknown, the gospel shall be preached to them. And he saw that in some way or another, that his voyage was helping to fulfill the Bible. I mean, here he quotes from Isaiah 51:5, "The isles shall wait upon me, and mine arm shall they trust." It says, "I will give unto thee as a light unto the Gentiles, that my salvation shall go to the end of the earth." And anyway, he writes this in his Libro de las Profecias. Columbus says, "It was the Lord that put it into my mind. I could feel his hand upon me. The fact that I could sail from here to the Indies. All who heard of my project rejected it with laughter, ridiculing me. But there was no doubt that the inspiration was from the Holy Spirit, because he comforted me with rays of marvelous illumination from the Holy Scriptures." And he goes on to say how he spends quite a bit of time, Dr. Stan, talking about the end of the world. and this is what was is motivating him to want to go on this journey. And he says, he quotes from St. Augustine, said that the gospel, or that the world shall end the seventh millennium after Adam. And he says that Cardinal Pierre de Ali, who went on to become Pope Pius II, but he said that, you know, there were 5,343 years and 318 days from Adam to the advent of our Lord Jesus up until this time. And then according to some other, you know, historian, there was another 1,501 years that have elapsed. And anyway, he comes up to somehow or another figuring that there's 155 years left for the fulfillment before the world would come to an end. And he says this, our Savior said that before the consummation of the world, all that was written by the prophets must be fulfilled. And so even though his timing was off, he did get motivated by the fact that the gospel was to be preached to the whole world before the end comes. And then he talks about how it's his hope that the finances from this trip to India, you know, would help the monarchs of Spain to restore the temple in Jerusalem back to the Holy Church. This is what he said. I had said that I would state the argument I have for the restitution of the Holy Temple to the Holy Church. And so he, again, this is the same king and queen that drove the Muslims out of Spain, and they were still in that crusade mode in Europe, and they thought, well, you know, we want to drive the Muslims out of the Christian area of Palestine. It was all Byzantine Christian. Obviously, that didn't happen, but it just gives you an idea of what was motivating Columbus.
And I really think that's what is so important about the story of William, is the fact that the average person doesn't understand that Columbus was deeply religious, and he looked upon this in many ways as a Christian crusade to be able to reach India, to perhaps be able to obtain wealth, but that wealth wasn't going to be for himself. It was going to be in pursuit of the continuation of the spreading of the gospel.
And, you know, what's interesting is his journals. Now, we don't have his original journals because they were lost, but before they were lost, a historian named Bartolomé de las Casas wrote an abstract of Columbus's journal. Basically, it was an outline, but in several places he put verbatim, word for word, what Columbus wrote. He says, October 10th, 1492, here the people could stand it no longer, and they were going to have a mutiny, but Columbus encouraged them. Then finally, on October 12th, 1492, it says, at 2 hours after midnight appeared land at a distance of 2 leagues. They handed all the sails and set the trio, which is the mainsail without bonnets, and laying to, waiting for daylight Friday, when they arrived at the island of the Bahamas, called in the Indian tongue Guanahani. Columbus named it San Salvador, which means Holy Savior. And he writes, so that they might be well disposed toward us, for I knew they were a people to be delivered and converted to our holy faith by love rather than by force, I gave some of them red caps and other glass beads, which they hung around their necks, and many other things of slight value. This they were greatly pleased, and became so entirely our friends it was a wonder to see. I believe they would easily be made Christians, for it seemed to me they had no religion of their own. Our Lord willing, when I depart, I shall bring 6 of them back to your highnesses, that they may learn to talk our language. He writes October 16th in his journal, I don't recognize in them any religion, and I believe they would very promptly turn Christian. And then he writes again on November 6th. He says, most serene princes, if they had access to devout religious persons knowing the language, they would all turn Christian. And I hope that your highnesses will do something about it with much care. So you can see over and over again, this is on his mind.
And I really think it's an amazing, amazing story. And this is the part of the story that is never taught in our schools today, that in many ways this was a missionary voyage. But then the one reason why Christopher Columbus is so derided and today and disparaged today and demonized today is because he was a Christian. In fact, at one time everybody knew America was a Christian nation, and yet you get up and say that today, you will be demonized, you will be marginalized. And because you see, there truly is today a conspiracy against God. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, William Federer. Well, Bill, why don't you pick up the story there?
Well, Columbus writes on November 27th of 1492 in his journal, he says, and I say that your highnesses ought not consent that any foreigner does business or sets foot here accepts Christian Catholics, and again, this is prior to the Reformation, since this was the end and the beginning of the enterprise, that it should be for the enhancement and the glory of the Christian religion. Nor should anyone who is not a good Christian come to these parts. In other words, he knew that the Indians could be very easily taken advantage of, and so he was trying to warn this. Well, a couple of interesting things happen at the end of his first voyage. They get to Cuba, and his captain, Pinzon, who sailed the Pinta, which was the second biggest ship, he disappears. He takes off with the ship looking for gold on his own. And so Columbus is only left with two ships, and then he gets to Haiti, and his Santa Maria, the big ship, runs aground. And so they salvage stuff off the ship, and since the Pinta is not there, and he can't fit the 40 extra sailors onto his little Nina, which was the smallest of the boats, he leaves those 40 sailors there. It happened to have happened on December 24th, which was Christmas Eve, and so he named the little settlement La Navidad, and he told the sailors to trade and build a fort, and he would come back within a year. And now we'll see in a minute how unfortunate this was, because the greed that got a hold of Pinzon, if he'd have been there, they could have put all these sailors on, because Columbus left not the best and the wisest and the people who were missionaries. He left a bunch of greedy sailors there, and it didn't turn out quite good. Anyway, he gets back to Spain. He's treated as a hero. Again, this was the longest voyage ever out of the side of the land. He claimed all the land for Spain. And his second trip, he takes off with 17 ships, 1,500 colonists. And these colonists are mostly noblemen. They're people that don't want to work. They want to get easy gold. And, of course, Columbus fell to the temptation of bragging, and he made it appear that, yes, all the Indians are friendly, and, yes, the gold is really easy to get. And so they came across on the second voyage and landed at Hispaniola, which is today Haiti, and came to the settlement of La Navidad and found that it was gone, that the Indians had killed them all. And the story that they could get out of the Indians was that they began fighting amongst themselves and then began to take women from the natives, and the natives just rose up and killed them. Well, this was very unfortunate, because these people that came with Columbus all of a sudden realized that this wasn't the pristine paradise. They felt like Columbus lied to them. And then a governor after Columbus decided to extract retribution from these Indian tribes and began to kill them. And there was five tribes on Haiti, and the one of them he killed, because it was the one that wiped out those 40 sailors, and it just sort of went downhill from there. But anyway, so that was a very unfortunate incident. So Columbus puts his brother in charge of the colony, and again, these are these noblemen. They don't want to do manual labor. The gold wasn't as easy to find as they thought, and Columbus's brothers, Bartholomew and then later Diego, gave in to their demands, and they demanded that they have land and that they be able to force the Indians to bring them gold. And at first they had sort of a head count where they were supposed to bring it, and then it ended up turning into slavery, and then of course the Western diseases got in there. But
hold that thought for just a moment as we bring other stations right back on board now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Federer, and we're telling the story of what happened on Columbus's second trip to the New World, and this time they landed on Haiti. But he's got an awful lot of noblemen with him who certainly didn't come along because they were pursuing the Christian faith. They wanted gold, they wanted land, and they didn't want to have to work. And so what had happened is that after Columbus had actually initially left a colony there sailors, supposedly they were going to have the first Spanish enclave there on Haiti, and they had, when they came back again, why they'd all been killed, because they had been stealing women from the natives, and the natives had retaliated by killing them. So the new governor comes in, and of course he starts slaughtering the natives there in retribution for having killed the whites, and yet, of course, the whites had violated the rights of the natives. Well, as it turned out, why then many of the noblemen who were there, who didn't want to work, began demanding demanding gold from the natives, and eventually they end up enslaving the natives and taking their land. And this has nothing to do with Christopher Columbus or his dream of bringing Christianity to the natives of the New World. But pick up the story from there, William.
Yeah, so, you know, even Virginia, the settlement up there, they had the problem with these noblemen thinking that they were a higher class and they didn't want to, you know, get their fingernails dirty. And so Columbus had and his brother had the hardest time trying to appease them. And one of them actually started a rebellion against Columbus and his brother. But I'm sort of jumping ahead. Columbus left his brother Bartholomew in charge, and he went on exploring some more. He thought that Haiti was Japan and that Cuba was part of mainland China. And and meanwhile, some of the people that came with Columbus began to get these tropical diseases, and then they began to discover cannibalism. They would come to an island and find human bones cooking in pots and human bones being gnawed and the flesh eaten away. Michele de Queno, an Italian nobleman who traveled with Columbus on his second voyage, writes this in 1495. He says, in the island of Santa Maria de Guadalupe, we took 12 very beautiful and very fat women, 15 to 16 years old, together with two boys of the same age. These had their genital organs cut to the belly. This we thought had done to prevent them from meddling with their wives or to fatten them up to eat them later. The boys and girls have been taken by the above-mentioned Caribs. The Caribs, whenever they catch Indians, eat them as we would eat kids, goats, and they say that a boy's flesh tastes better than that of a woman's. Of this flesh, they are very greedy. He says, we went to the temple of the Caribs and found two wooden statues. We're told that whenever someone's father is sick, the son goes to the temple and tells the idol. If the idol says his father's not going to recover, he goes and cuts his father's head off and cooks it. I do not believe they eat it, but truly it is white when they place it in the above-mentioned temple. I mean, real gory stuff. Then there's Dr. Diego Alvarez Chanca, who was Columbus's chief physician on his second voyage. And he writes, we inquired of the inhabitants who these Caribs were. And, of course, Carib is the Spanish word for cannibal. And so they had so many of these experiences. There were two main tribal groups in the Caribbean. One was the Arawaks, who were the friendly ones, and the other was the Caribs. And there was so much cannibalism that they named it the Cannibal Sea or the Caribbean Sea.
I never heard that before. And, you know, everybody gives you the idea of the wicked white man and, of course, the noble savages. But these really weren't very noble savages, were they?
No. Dr. Chanca, Alvarez Chanca, writes, they told us the Caribs use them with such cruelty that they eat the children which the enslaved women bear to them, and they only bring up those children they have with their native wives. It says they declare that a flesh of a man is good to eat, but nothing can compare with it. And he says that this is evident for the human bones we found in the houses, and everything that could be gnawed had already been gnawed so that nothing remained. Anyway, they would come upon large numbers of captive females and some 20 handsome women that were being held in prisoners. It says, when the Caribs take away boys as prisoners of war, they remove their organs, fatten them, and then when they wish to have a great feast, they kill and eat them. Terrible, terrible stuff. And, of course, this was also going on the mainland of Mexico. The story of the Aztecs is well known. You know that the reason Cortez was just 500 men was able to conquer all of Mexico was because the other tribes wanted to break free of the Aztecs, because the Aztecs required them to deliver up a group of young men and young women every year to be have their hearts ripped out and roll down the temples and people would eat them. And they viewed the Spaniards as the saviors, freeing them from the Aztecs. Unfortunately, the Western diseases, especially smallpox, devastated many Indians because they had no immunity.
Now you hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Federer. We're going to tell you the real story of what this is all about, not about the noble Aztecs. And, of course, here in California, they want to reconstitute Aztecland as if somehow at one time this belonged to the Aztecs. We want to return to that form of life. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is William Federer. And William is telling us the story of what really happened when the white man came to the Western Hemisphere, and of course what was going on in Haiti, what was going on in the Caribbean islands, and the reason it was called Caribbean, it had to do with the Caribs, and of course they were cannibals. It was referring to this, the Caribbean was the cannibal area, and they found the same thing, of course, certainly, when they got to Cortez got to Mexico, the Aztecs were brutal, killing people, sacrificing literally thousands of people a day, cutting out their hearts and eating them. But you go ahead and tell us, continue with the story, William.
So a lot of those Indians looked at the Spaniards as coming to save them from the Caribs and save them from the Aztecs, you know, when Cortez was a generation later. But what happened is, while Columbus was out discovering on his second voyage, some more people who were on his settlement began complaining more and more and getting on their ships and going back to Spain, saying that it's not what, you know, Columbus told us, it's not the easy-to-get-rich-quick paradise. And Columbus goes back to Spain to answer these accusations. The king and queen believe him, and they allow him to go on a third voyage. Now, the third voyage, he's caught in the doldrums. He goes down the western coast of Africa, and the doldrums is a situation when you're in the open sea and there's no wind and no current. You're just sitting there frying in the hot sun. Columbus prays that if the wind picks up, he'll name the first island he sees after the Trinity. And he did. He named it Trinidad, and that has that name to this day. And he just went around north part of South America and the Arauco River and all those different areas, Venezuela, and finally makes his way back to Hispaniola, to his colony. And instead of a warm reception, unbeknownst to him, the king and queen sent a replacement governor. And this replacement governor decides to put Columbus and his brother in chains. And then he sends them back to Spain as prisoners. So Columbus ended his third voyage in the belly of his ship, being taken back. And the captain, to his credit, offered to take Columbus's chains off because he respected him. But Columbus said, no, if the king ordered these put on, I want the king to see him. And of course, then he finally walks in to the court, and the king and queen order the chains off, and they hear his side of the story. They had removed his titles. You know, I mean, they had believed the other guys. And so Columbus is laid up for a couple years there in Spain.
Hold that thought for just a moment. William, we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Federer, and of course, this is Columbus Day. We're telling the story of Christopher Columbus, but before I go on, I wanted to give William a chance to get his website out and how you can get in touch with him. Now, he's written a number of books, some of them which we carry, America's God and Country, either the book or the CD, and then, of course, the book on St. Patrick and the book on St. Nicholas and the book on George Washington Carver. And then what's that latest one that you've done, William?
The latest one's called Backfired, A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Religion.
And we even carry that one. We think these are all very important books. But why don't you get your website out so people can go and take a look at it and know about the other items that you do carry?
Well, it's AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and people can sign up for my free daily email called An American Minute, short little historical vignettes, what happened on each date in American history, and of course the one for the 10th and the 12th is on Columbus. But I encourage the listeners to purchase the books through Radio Liberty to help support you, Dr. Stan, the tremendous work that you're doing. But the book America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations, has quite an extensive collection of quotes from Columbus and from his journals and from his letters, and you can see over and over again that faith played a very strong part in his life, and that's the part that's been left out of the most politically correct school textbooks.
And it certainly is, because the last thing they want to, the children, school children in America, and even the adults, to realize is that there was a destiny for America, and it was a Christian destiny, and God did not only guide Christopher Columbus, but the founding fathers of this country, the Pilgrims, and, of course, then the founding of America back in 1776, when our Declaration of Independence was actually written, and stating that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. You see, there was a God, and God gave us our rights, and that's the last thing that those who would establish an authoritarian society in America want the American people to know. That we were formed here as a Christian nation. Everybody knew we were a Christian nation. Not that everybody had to be a Christian, and not that we would have a theocracy, but the foundations of our freedom were based upon the Christian faith, which said that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And you could only have limited government if you had moral people, and that had to be self-government, where we were answerable to God rather than to government for what we did. Of course, now we're getting away from that. We have video cameras being put in every place. Everybody's being monitored. Certainly all telephone messages, all emails, all faxes are being monitored by the echelon through the National Security Agency and their counterparts in Great Britain. Because you see, there are those who do not believe in liberty under God. They believe, of course, in tyranny under total government. So let's get back to the history of America, because the history of Christopher Columbus and his voyages is seminal to an understanding of why America was founded. It's a history you're not going to find being taught in our schools today. So Christopher Columbus returns after his third voyage to Great Britain, and of course he has been arrested, he's been put in chains, and he comes then before the King and Queen of Spain in chains, and when they hear his story, they realize they've been lied to, and that Christopher Columbus has not been a scoundrel at all. He's been faithful to them and to the Lord. So pick up the story there, please, Bill.
So while Columbus is laid up in Spain, he writes his Libro de las Profecias, his Book of Prophecies, and in there he says this. He says, "I've already said that for the execution of the enterprise of the Indies, neither reason nor mathematics nor world maps were profitable to me. Rather, it was what the prophecy of Isaiah was to be completely fulfilled." And so he goes on.
What was that prophecy? Do you recall what was the exact wording of it?
Well, the ones he quotes is the ones where it says, you know, the isles of the sea shall wait upon me, and another one, Isaiah 69, says, "Surely the isles wait for me, and the ships of Tarshish first to bring thy sons from afar." And then another place in Isaiah 65:1 says, "I sought them, and they asked for me, I found them, and they sought me not. And I said, Behold, unto me, unto a nation that was not called by my name." And then he quotes from Isaiah 49:6 says, "I will also give thee as a light to the Gentiles, that thou mightest be my salvation to the ends of the earth." Isaiah 49:1, he says, "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from afar. The Lord has called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother. He has mentioned my name." Another, Isaiah 42:10, he says, "Sing unto the Lord new song, for his praise unto the ends of the earth. Ye that go down to the sea, and all that are therein, the isles and the inhabitants thereof." And so these are the different ones where, and then of course Matthew, where it says, "Go and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost." And then he says Acts 1:8, "But ye shall receive power," and it says, "Be witnesses to me, Jerusalem and Samaria and Judea, all under the uttermost parts of the earth." He was quite familiar with the Bible and had studied it, and so this shows what was, you know, going on in his heart and his mind. Now he didn't think the world was flat either. It's interesting that everybody back then knew the earth was round. I mean, even Ptolemy in the 2nd century AD in Egypt wrote about how there was a common ocean that connected Europe and Asia. And so the story of that confrontation in the King of Spain's court, where the saying of the earth was flat and Columbus said, "No, it's round," that was something made up by Washington Irving. He was the author that gave us Rip Van Winkle and Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And just like today, Hollywood will take a story from history and change it because they want to make it a more captivating storyline. that's what happened with Washington Irving. He just sort of added these little things in there. Unfortunately, got taught for years that the people thought the Earth was flat, but no, everybody knew it was round. They just didn't know how big around. Columbus actually thought it was about half or even a third of the diameter that it really is. And if that were actually the case, then he would have indeed been over in India. And but there were different measurements for a mile. A Portuguese mile was one length, and an Italian mile was another length. And, you know, they didn't have global satellite positioning and so forth. It was pretty rudimentary. But nevertheless, Columbus went on four voyages. First, he discovered land. The second, they discovered cannibals. The third is when he got sent back in chains. And then the fourth, the king and queen finally let him go on a fourth voyage, but they tell him that his purpose was to find the path to India, and that he was not supposed to go to Hispaniola, to Haiti, because he didn't want to, you know, let there be any more strife. Well, Columbus is coming across the ocean and sees the mother of all storms brewing in the Caribbean, a hurricane. And he sends word to the new governor of Hispaniola, of the settlement there in Haiti, and he asks if he can put his ship into the harbor. Well, the new governor thumbs his nose at him and says, no, you can't come in. And Columbus finds out that the new governor is taking off with 24 ships laden with gold to go back to Spain, and he begs him to stay in the port. But the king, I mean, this new governor is not about to listen to Columbus. Columbus has to go further down the coast, find some place to anchor and tie down. The hurricane hits. 23 of the ships sink, and only one ship limps its way back to Spain, and that happens to be the one that was carrying Columbus's portion of the gold. His deal with the king and queen was that he would get 2% of the gold that was discovered in the New World. And anyway, lo and behold, one of the ships that sank had on it that governor that had thrown Columbus in chains at the end of his third voyage. And so sort of a little bit of a retribution there. Anyway, the storms toss Columbus around the Caribbean month after month. At one place, he talks about how it lightninged for 4 days in a row. And he was washed up on the coast of Panama, and his boat was getting worm-eaten with these mollusks that would, you know, eat holes in the wood, and so the ships were getting waterlogged and sitting lower and lower in the water. And meanwhile, he had caught a disease. He has arthritis, and I don't know if it was malaria or one of those type of tropical diseases, and so he has a cot set up on the top deck and with a canopy, and so he's trying to sail the boat while lying down, you know, in heaven, giving orders to the sailors. They go into a river there in Panama and try to get fresh water, but the tide goes out, and the boat's sitting low in the water, and the Indians attack, and so they have to abandon one of their ships there in Panama. And then another ship sinks, so out of his four ships, he has two of them left, and they began to sink lower in the water. Now they have twice as many sailors on them because the other ship sank, and they can't stay up any longer, so they are marooned on Jamaica for an entire year in 1502. And here is Columbus, the great explorer, shipwrecked, and he gets wind that the natives, who were at first friendly, are passing rumors that they're going to wipe him out. And so he notices in his almanac that a lunar eclipse is scheduled. And this is about when celestial navigation began to be discovered. And so he tells the Indians that if they don't treat him right, he'll pray and God will blot out the moon. Sort of like, you know, Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, that Mark Twain story.
Oh, I remember that was a wonderful, wonderful story.
And so anyway, that they didn't believe him, but that night the moon goes black, and so these Indians scream and wail, and they come to Columbus bringing presents, and so he doesn't have any problem with them after that. They take care of him. Columbus's close friend Mendez gets some Indians, and they get in a canoes, and they canoe the 300-mile journey from Jamaica to Hispaniola, and they get there, but the new governor, the third governor now, is in no hurry to send a rescue ship, and so he sort of lets Columbus sit there for about 7 months, finally goes and rescues him. By this time, Columbus is sick, he's old, he's, you know, lost the energy, and he goes back to Spain. He's not there but a month, but and Queen Isabella dies, and so he realizes that he's not going to be able to go back to the New World. He writes his will, and in his will, he actually writes to his son and instructs his son Diego that the land that the title that Columbus had, Admiral of the Ocean Seas, was taken away after the the third voyage, but then it was given back to him. And so his son was basically the inheritor of the title of governor of Veraguay, which was the part of Panama, the coast there. And he writes to him in his will that the son should set aside funds to support ministers and teachers of our holy faith to minister and take care of the Indians. This is what he said: "And I also order said Don Diego, my son, to him who will inherit said Mayoraguio, that he will help maintain and sustain on the island of Espanola four good teachers of our holy theology, with the intention to convert to our holy religion all those people in the Indies. And when it pleases God that the income from the Mayoraguio will increase, that then will be increased the number of such devoted people who will help all these people to become Christians. And may he not worry about the money that is necessary to spend for that purpose." So here in Columbus's last will and testament, he's instructing his son to help spread the gospel to the New World. And then he finally dies, and his last words were, "Into thy hands I commit my spirit." And just an amazing life that really did change the course of the world. And we're still partakers and benefits of that. And you even look at the list of the things that came from the New World back to the Old World, and you have things like chocolate, potatoes, tomatoes, pineapples, chili peppers, cocoa, just item after item, turkey, domesticated turkey, quinine, all kinds of different things that the Indians had, and that brought back hammocks, the whole idea of sleeping on a boat, that you don't have to rock back and forth. Those potatoes, they went back to Europe and became a staple. And many times there were plagues in Europe, and the potatoes is what saved them. Of course, the potatoes got all the way to Russia, and they turned it into vodka. And the potatoes were so important to Ireland that several centuries later, when Ireland had its potato famine, the potatoes died, they didn't have anything else to eat. And so that's when the Irish came to America. But potatoes had vitamin C, and so the sailors who used to get scurvy when they began to eat potatoes, they didn't get scurvy. So just a real change in the whole world happened because of Columbus, and that's why we recognize him and the contributions that he made. It is unfortunate that there were, and I traced two strands throughout history, two threads: greed and the gospel. You have people that are motivated by the gospel, people that are, like the missionaries that start orphanages and hospitals and medical clinics, like William Carey, the missionary to India, who ended the Hindu practice of sati, where the women were expected to throw themselves on their husband's funeral pyre when their husband died. Or you have Gladys Aylward that stopped the Chinese practice of binding of the little girl's feet, so they couldn't grow. And then you have the missionaries that went to Africa that stopped the twin killing. Those different tribes in Africa would, if there was a twin born, they would kill one of them. The different medical clinics and hospitals and the free vaccinations and things like, Billy Graham and Franklin Graham with the Samaritan's Purse and, Operation Rescue. You have people that are really acting out Christ, and they've always been throughout history. At the same time, you have people that, whether they call themselves Christians or not, they're not following the example of Christ. And those are the ones that try to cheat the Indians and, break the treaties and, enter into the slave trade and do all those type of things. And even today, you have people who are willing to vote their pocketbook, even though it means promoting immorality. So that same lust for financial benefit at the expense of morals and expense of faith still exists to this day. And it just, takes on a different name. But those are the two threads that I trace throughout history, And I truly believe Columbus had good intentions, but those that followed after him, and even during his lifetime, tried to pressure him into allowing them to treat the Indians bad. And then after he was gone, they treated him very bad. There was old Bartolomé de las Casas was called the Apostle to the Indies, and he recorded a lot of those things and printed them into a book. And when it was circulated in Europe, tremendous pressure was put on Spain to stop the practice of treating the Indians with disrespect.
All right, well, you hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Our guest has been Bill Federer. And, of course, his telephone number is 888-USA-WORD, and his website is www.AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com, the telephone number, 888-USA-WORD. We'll be right back here in just a moment, here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Federer. We've been talking about the story of Christopher Columbus, and you know, it's really such an inspiring story when you really hear the truth about this man who was so instrumental in discovering the Western Hemisphere that we have all sort of benefited so richly from, and yet a story that is poorly told today. What sort of response do you get when you tell people the story, Will?
Oh, they're fascinated. They haven't heard it. They hear the, you know, the politically correct version that he came over here for the purpose of enslaving the natives. It's like, you know, no, he actually thought he was going to India. I mean, even after his third voyage, he was still convinced that India was and China were right around there somewhere. And just about everybody else knew that it wasn't. And but Columbus, you know, thought that. And matter of fact, if he would have realized that it was a new land, then it probably would have gotten his name. But because he kept insisting it was not, you know, a new continent, he didn't, you know, they ended up giving the name to Amerigo Vespucci, who is some, you know, Italian map maker that came here once and, you know, discovered part of South America, you know, I mean, not anything exciting. You know, I do think that, it's important to realize the value that faith played in it. And over and over again in Columbus's writings and in his journals, he asks the king and queen of Spain to send over teachers of Christianity and religion for the Indians. And you know, it's always easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, but when you if you've ever led any type of organization, you know, it's one thing when you're going forward and you got your vision. It's nothing when you have, you know, 1,500 you know, spoiled, greedy people that, you know, came over and, you know, had all these high expectations to get rich quick, and when it wasn't there, and when they started catching diseases and stuff, that they began to pressure Columbus to basically change and allow them to begin to do a lot of the bad treatment of the Indians. And so that the greed and the gospel, those two threads are something that we always see through history, and unfortunately they existed right there at the beginning of the discovery of the New World.
And they believe it existed here in the United States, really, the Christian influence and the evil influence. But that's a subject for another evening. Bill Federer, thank you so very much for being with us on Columbus Day to tell us the story of Christopher Columbus, the real story.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. And it was in 1892, 400 years after Columbus discovered America, that the Pledge of Allegiance was first recited.
Hold that thought for just a moment, and we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill was just saying it was about 400 years after Columbus discovered America that the Pledge of Allegiance was first recited. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, and it was at the 400th anniversary and the National School Celebration at the Chicago World's Fair. And then, of course, it was later that Eisenhower put the phrase "under God" into the Pledge of Allegiance. That was taken from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But the pledge was written by a Baptist minister from New York. But, again, the Pledge of Allegiance was very first recited on Columbus Day, October 12th, in 1892. And it was FDR, by the way, in 1937, that made Columbus Day an annual observance. And so a lot of neat history goes into this. They actually wanted to name America, the United States, after Columbia. They didn't, but they did name the District of Columbia, where our capital is, after Columbia. And many of the different cities, like Columbus, Ohio, and so forth, the Columbia River Valley in Oregon. So he has a long-lasting impact that the whole world knows his name, and it all started with a vision that he had. And he talks about how 7 years he tried to get the financing for his trip and kept getting no answers, but finally he kept pushing it. I heard somebody say he had to sell before he could sail. He had to, you know, convince of his vision. And so that's the encouragement that we have.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to have to let you go, but God bless you. Thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. All right. Well, that was Bill William Federer. I certainly hope that you've enjoyed the program. And, of course, this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to our program, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you do that by contacting us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, I would suggest the June 2005 newsletter called The Occult Hierarchy Part 2. What is the occult hierarchy? Why, behind everything that's going on today, back of all that the foes have plotted, back of all that the saints have planned, behind the schemes of men and demons is a higher hidden hand. Well, there's God's hand, and there truly is a demonic hand at work within our society. Those two threads that Bill talked about, and the occult hierarchy is the demonic thread. You can go to their website on the Internet, simply Google in the word occult hierarchy, and read articles that are written by people who are part of the movement who talk about the plan, and plan is spelled with a capital P because they deify it. We'll be glad to send you a copy of my newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at radioliberty.com, radioliberty.com. Remember, you can listen to our programs on the Here's Help Radio Network at 3 o'clock every afternoon. That's 3 o'clock every afternoon on the Here's Help Radio Network. And then we are having an all-day conference here in the Monterey Bay area on the 19th of November. And if it's a Saturday, if you'd like to come, you'll have to have a reservation. Call us at 1-800-544-8927 and then pray for America. Pray for a revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, there's a wonderful poem about Christopher Columbus, but the last two versions, last two stanzas. They sailed, then spake the mate. This mad sea shows her teeth tonight. He curls his lips, he lies in wait with lifted teeth as if to bite. Brave Admiral, say but one good word. What shall we do when hope is gone? The words leapt like a leaping sword. Sail on, sail on, sail on, sail on. Then pale and worn he kept his deck and peered through darkness. Ah, that night. Of all dark nights, and then a speck, a light, a light, a light, a light. It grew, a starlight flag unfurled. It grew to be time's burst of dawn. He gained a world, he gave that world its grandest lesson. On, sail on. We'll be right back. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask you not to call until we ask specifically for questions, because we have with us on the line right now a good friend, Bob Chapman, who publishes on a weekly basis the International Forecaster, which I get every Sunday and look forward to and read to keep abreast of not only what's happening on the international financial markets, but a lot of the information you're not going to get through the controlled media here in the United States and throughout the world. So, Bob Chapman, thank you so very much for being with us tonight. Bob, are you there?
Very nice to be back. Yes, I am.
All right, fine. Well, of course, things are really rather exciting. A lot of things are happening, as you point out in your latest forecaster. And just for our listeners, perhaps we could just touch on what we've seen this last couple of weeks, and that is almost an explosion of gold and silver prices. I mean, moving up really steadily, and even though the dollar seems to be rising, gold and silver seem to be rising, which is a paradox. Usually, when the dollar falls, gold goes up. When the dollar rises, why, gold goes down. But that doesn't seem to be the case now, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it shows that gold has broken away from its following the dollar, and following in the fact of going lower when the dollar goes higher, as you said, and vice versa. And so gold is on its own, and the reason that it is is it's broken out to the upside in every major currency, and that is making people throughout the world take notice, particularly people in countries that don't trust their own currency. India is a very good example. India is the largest producer of the largest consumer of gold in the world, and so they obviously see what's going on, but we're starting to see it in Europe and other places, and that's why the physical offtake is so powerful and so overwhelming to the elitists who are presently manipulating the gold and silver market and other markets as well.
And I think that's so important for our listeners to understand. The reason that they manipulate the precious metals market is because they don't want us to have anything of inherent value to trade in. They want to force us to have to use their fiat money. They can print all the money they want to and create all the wealth out of absolutely nothing. But they know that the only true wealth is gold and silver, so they artificially manipulate the price down, and they've been doing that for a long time. And what's really so interesting, Bob, is as I read the newspapers here and watch television here, there's really no mention hardly about what's happening to gold and silver. Certainly people throughout the rest of the world know it, but it's not being talked about, you know. Only when the price is at the highest and it's ready to fall will you begin to see it talked about on the evening news. They tell us what happens to the stock market. But, of course, all money is mediated in gold and silver, and this is hardly ever mentioned here for the general public. It's almost as if they don't want us to know that these markets are beginning to break out. Have you had that feeling?
Yes. A good example is CNBC. They come on at 5 a.m., and after the market opens at 9:30 Eastern time, they don't show the price of gold anymore.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman. And you're going to learn a lot this evening. I always learn something from him. We'll be back in just a moment. Bob Chapman, the International Forecaster. Well, I guess this evening, Bob Chapman, the International Forecaster, he was just saying that on MSNBC, when they just don't share the price of gold. You know, they always used to when it was low. But now that it's beginning to take off, they just suddenly, is that right? They're just not putting that out or announcing it?
They just stopped flashing that particular item.
I wonder why that would be. It's almost as if they don't want the American people to know that it's beginning to break out.
Absolutely, and they've been doing that for a long time. It's what you might call media manipulation. And, you know, it goes on in a lot of sectors. You know, I've been involved in the markets for 46 years, and so I'm very sensitive to it, very attuned to it. And so it's easy for me to pick up and see. And I've done radio and television since the late 1960s. And so, you know, you get a feel for that as well. And so, yes, they're manipulating the news.
And I saw the gold was up about, what, 70 today?
Well, earlier in the day, in the European markets, gold was up several dollars. And as soon as New York opened, they knocked it down. And it was up 60 cents on the day. And it's just another one of their classical manipulations. On Friday, with 20 minutes to go in the stock market, the Dow was down 100 points, and miraculously it ended up 5 points on the day.
Now, what you're basically saying is all being manipulated. I suppose these orders come in from these areas in the Caribbean. Nobody knows what they are, but it's really all part of this organized government manipulation of the markets.
Absolutely. It's part of the framework of corporate fascism. To manipulate everything, and the international, transnational conglomerates are all deeply involved in this, and that leads to other things, which is part of control, such as free trade and globalization. And so, you know, these people are doing what they want to do. You know, the same thing is true in other spheres where they manipulate the public. You don't see hardly any information on the illegal alien problem as well. They keep it out of the press unless they just totally cannot suppress it. And so...
Hold that thought right there. We're going to bring other stations back on board in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Bob Chapman. He was simply saying that last Friday why the market was down almost 100 points until just before the closing bell. And then the people, when they call it the plunge protection team, it's illegal. Well, it really isn't illegal. As long as the government's doing it, it's all right. They manipulated the stock market right back up again. And then he simply points out how this everything is being manipulated by the international corporations. But the difficulty is they can only get away with this as long as America is the predominant force in the world. Unfortunately, America is running a massive deficit year after year. Right now, we are consuming 7% more than we produce. We have a growing deficit every year. We're totally dependent upon loans from other countries to keep our house of cards going, and certainly the central banks throughout the world and in Japan and other countries in China are using their money to keep America afloat. But we are not being able to keep afloat on our own. And should there be a major cataclysmic event, which Bob talks about in his latest newsletter, whether it be a nuclear war or whether it be some natural disaster, but something could certainly precipitate a financial crisis that would bring the whole house of cards down and impoverish so many, tens of, if not hundreds of millions of people here in the United States. So you pick up the story there, Bob. You certainly mentioned that we are skating on very thin ice as a nation, aren't we?
Yeah, especially financially. And, you know, you have Katrina and Rita hurricanes could have been the catalyst to shove this thing over the edge. We just don't know yet. And, of course... they were unexpected events.
Well, I think it's so interesting that the president has promised at least $200 billion to rebuild that area. And now, of course, there's a great earthquake over in Pakistan, and now he's promising to give money to them. And, why, of course, we've got the tremendous amounts of money he's going to spend on the Medicare drug bill. It's money we don't have. We're having to borrow money to keep afloat. And the president insists on spending money and now giving money to other countries because they have a catastrophe. This is madness, isn't it?
It certainly is. And, you know, we still have a foreign aid program that gives away about $12 billion a year. But a good part of that goes to Israel and Egypt. And, you know, because they're friends of ours, that doesn't mean that we have to support them. And, you know, I can understand them helping Pakistan in a situation like that. But, you know, you're right. When you add it to all of the other things that are going on, the amount of money that's being wasted is just preposterous. And it just goes on and on. There's so many sectors. And, you know, that's why the international forecaster runs anywhere between 35 and 65 pages a week. I mean, that's the size of a third of a book. And we put this out every week because there's so much going on there that the public doesn't know about. It just is not in the news.
And I really, it's fascinating. There's so much great information going into the background of what's really happening to Ford and General Motors. And yeah, they're bonds right now, they're junk bonds. You're talking about them even having to go lower than junk. Is that possible?
You mean General Motors?
Yes, General Motors and Ford.
Yeah, I believe that General Motors has been deliberately set on the course to go bankrupt. And the course was set 25 years ago, and that's how far ahead these people plan.
Well, that way they can dump their pension obligations and leave all their employees already destitute.
Well, if you count in Delphi along with Northwest and Delta, that's an additional it's an additional $30 billion, and they're offside. That's the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, 23 now, so that's $53 billion we're on the hook for, with only six companies maybe.
You're talking now about the deficits, the pensions that they owe, that the companies aren't going to have to be able to fund, and so the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is the government agencies, going to have to pick up those pensions, and what are they going to do, pay pennies on the dollar of obligation?
They usually pay somewhere between 25 and 60%. The average being about one-third, and first of all, the retiree gets screwed, and the second of all, the American taxpayer does, and it's the worst of all worlds. And how does this happen? Well, these crooks who run corporations, and I hate to put it that way, but that's exactly what they are, they take that money to run their companies when their companies have problems, and even when their companies don't have problems, they opportune that money in different investment spheres or within their own company, and that's why that problem exists. And the situation for General Motors and Ford is irretrievable. The amounts of money are too large. And you saw the bankruptcy over the weekend, which is Delphi. That's 188,000 employees. There's 45,000 they're asking to take a drop from $26 to $28 an hour to $10 to $12 an hour. And this is all a result of free trade and globalization.
Now what does Delphi produce?
Auto parts.
They're affiliated then with the major automakers.
They used to be part of General Motors. They were spun off. Now they're back under General Motors. They couldn't get away with the spin-off.
Now, basically, they're asking them to take a cut. How much in pay?
Two-thirds. They want them to go to $10 to $12 an hour.
And they've been getting, what, $30 an hour?
Mm-hmm.
How much have they been getting?
$26 to $28 an hour.
So take almost a two-thirds cut in pay. The alternative will be you either take that and keep your job, or we're going to probably move over to China. Is that what it's about?
No, not probably. They are.
All right.
They've been warned that we'll be out of here within 5 years total. And the Chinese are going to ship over in behalf of Ford, from Ford and GM factories in China, 300,000 cars and two 007, and that's only a little over a year from now. And the following year, they expect to put 1.5 million cars into America. And so all GM will do is carry the brand name if they're still in business, although they may be vulturized and the names may be sold, Pontiac, Ford, you know, the different types of vehicles.
And, of course, they can produce those cars so much more cheaply over in China, and they can come up with exactly the same quality that we have here, and they will simply put the at least the standard American corporations out of business, although Toyota and Nissan and Honda seem to be doing fairly well here. It is the traditional American corporations that are going right under, isn't that right?
That's right. And, you know, people don't realize that parts of New York, northern Ohio and Indiana, Michigan, and southern Quebec and Ontario, which includes the outside of the Toronto area, they're all going to be ghost towns.
I think it's really so important that people understand that this is planned, long-range planning. Now, how can Toyota and Honda and Nissan do so much better? They don't have the tremendous pension load. I mean, General Motors could make any sort of a promise, you know, as far as their pension promises to the unions. But, of course, they lied because they had never had any intention of actually paying that off, knowing full well that globalization would mean that they would be moving out of this country. They would simply go bankrupt. They would leave their people who lent them money. And what is General Motors' overall debt? You quoted that a couple of times. I want to be talking about $30 or $40 or $100 billion or something?
Yeah, and they have enough cash to last them for 3 years. But they're losing money on their automobile operation, have been for the last 3 years.
You can't just sell at a loss everything you produce and make it up in volume, that's for sure.
Well, what's been offsetting that is the financing division, which is GMAC and Ford Credit. And they've been making money, which has been offsetting, but not enough offsetting. But you know, they knew that this was going to happen. They planned it that way. This just didn't happen. This has been going on for 25 years. It's the total destruction of the American economy. And virtually nobody gets it out there. I don't know of any other newsletter who puts it the way I do.
And I think
who tells the people exactly what's happening.
I think it's so important that people understand there is a master plan, and that is to ship the manufacturing to India and to China and to Russia and to Brazil. And America then will be left as a service nation with people really looking after one another. But the master plan is to lower our living standards and impoverish our people. When you understand that, when you understand that we are intentionally shipping our jobs, we are intentionally shipping our factories, and you understand we are intentionally shipping our wealth to other countries to lower our living standards, then everything makes sense, doesn't it, Bob?
They want us on our knees so that we will, with open arms, accept world government.
And that's all right. That's exactly what it's all about, because the common denominator behind everything going on today is the New World Order and the New World Religion. Obama, one of our listeners, had called and asked about who really owns the stock in these foreign companies, the Toyotas, the Hyundai, the Honda, Nissan. Is there some sort of, things going on, some hanky-panky behind the scenes, some ties into American production and American capitalism and American corporate social...
Well, I don't have the details needless to say in front of me, but the answer is yes. It's not hanky-panky. It's just straight-up investments. But you got to remember, they know what's going on. They know what's planned. They know what's going to happen. I mean, it's just like NAFTA, followed by CAFTA, followed by FTAA, followed by a regional bloc with one currency, with no borders, and then that to be amalgamated into the world government. It's the same thing.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with our special guest this evening, Bob Chapman, the international forecaster. And you need to know what's going on, and you're not going to hear it elsewhere. That's why you want to stay tuned to Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Bob Chapman. And, of course, those of you who want that very informative authoritarian, what's program is called the West Wing. And, of course, they use that to condition the minds of the American people. Very well done, very informative. But we had, of course, one of the heroes of the program talking about CAFTA and how CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Zone, actually was going to mean more jobs for the American people. It was going to enrich us. It was going to give us an opportunity to sell to all those people in the Central America, and how good it was going to be for them, and how we were going to raise their living standards, and we were going to make a lot of money raising their living standards. Well, of course, the program, as with so many television programs, is aimed at creating our reality. The truth of the matter is that the purpose of NAFTA and CAFTA and the Free Trade Zone of the Americas and the World Trade Organization is to impoverish the American people. But if they told them that, why, the American people would be furious with their elected representatives and vote the scoundrels out of office. So they, of course, lie to us, and our politicians lie to us. And then we have these programs like the West Wing, come on, and creating our reality. And this handsome presidential candidate talks about how CAFTA is going to mean so many more jobs for the American people and so much more prosperity for America, as all global trade brings prosperity. How would you address that statement, Bob?
Well, of course, it's not going to do that, and NAFTA didn't do that. And if NAFTA had done that, then we wouldn't have 20 million illegal aliens in the United States. And, of course, they've come here since 1987, but for the most part, most of them have come since 1994 when NAFTA began. And in the last few years, we've been absolutely inundated because everybody expects that they're going to have amnesty. And the problem with NAFTA has been that the farming part of it drove all of the small farmers out of business. And these farmers, of course, have no education, are in poor health, and they go to the big cities like Mexico City and Guadalajara, and they can't find sufficient work because of their shortcomings. And so the next step is that they go over the border and they go into the United States, and that's why we have 20 million of them. But the real profits in the exchange between the United States and Mexico have been internationalist, transnational corporations. It's as simple as that. They've been the money makers. Yes, some people have a better life because of it. And of course, one of the good things in Mexico, those that own property and own homes, they're going to pay for it. There is no mortgages in Mexico. And the same is true in Europe, for that matter. And through most areas of the world, except for the United States and England and Australia and New Zealand, in Canada, most people pay a great deal of money down in their homes. But the point is that the benefits are not there. I mean, we've gotten the worst of all worlds in the whole thing.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Bob. Hold that thought, Bob. We're going to bring our other stations back on board right about now. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Bob Chapman, he's simply saying that that what we have is the worst of all worlds, that the concepts of NAFTA and CAFTA are really going to impoverish our people even further. And really one of the interesting things in your latest newsletter, Bob, was you were simply quoting a gentleman, his name was Professor Robert Pastor, from the Council on Foreign Relations, who testified before one of the government committees here that the real program is going to be to unite the Northern Hemisphere. And instead of trying to guard our border with Mexico, we should guard Mexico's southern border so that people could move readily back and forth between Mexico and the United States and Canada, and we could sort of amalgamate the northern hemisphere here all together, and then we would try to keep people out, not at the Mexican border, but at the southern Mexican border, and unite the three countries. That was an amazing statement. The Council on Foreign Relations has a plan. And for those of you who don't know what it is the group that, according to their own statement, guides the world. That was the phrase that James Wolfson used at David Rockefeller's 90th birthday. Where would the world be if they didn't have this organization, the Council on Foreign Relations, to guide the world? And one of the things they want to guide us to is simply just uniting with Mexico. Isn't that an incredible thing? The average American has no idea what this is about, do they?
Well, in 2010, they're supposed to, through the Security and Prosperity Partnership, they're supposed to do away with the borders. Now, you haven't read this anywhere. I get this out of Washington here in the last several days. Maybe somebody else has picked it up, but Karl Rove, who is the special assistant to the president, is telling Congress on the cuff, so to speak, it's not been in the news at all, that what they're going to do is give illegal aliens a free ride for 6 years, and then they have to go home from whence they came and reapply. Well, what he didn't tell you is that this Security and Prosperity Partnership is implemented in 5 years, in 2010, so that they won't have to do that, and they'll be free to do what they want between now and then, and then afterwards. And it's just another scam.
And I think what's so incredible, I think what's so incredible, Bob, is these elitists, these corporate fascists, and Karl Rove is a perfect example of that. He's part of the establishment. They know exactly what's going on, and they're concealing it from the American people. And the only reason they can do that is because of the control of the media. That there are five mega corporations that tie into this, and those five mega corporations control the media. Bertelsmann, Disney, Fox, Viacom, and Time Warner. They dominate 95% of the media in America, and by so doing, they can effectively control what the American people think. Most people don't understand there is a plan, and they simply lie to the American people, don't they?
Well, you should see the emails that I get in regard to what I have on my site, which is not a lot. In regard to the forecast, or maybe 5 or 6 pages. And we get about a half a million hits a month, which is very, very high. And which one of the things that's disturbing, we get, you know, one of the biggest points of interest in our site, and yet we get very, very few subscribers. So most of these people are looking for free information. But I've been getting letters today. I got one pertaining to what we were just talking about in the illegal immigration, but more so the letter talked about the previous part of the conversation, which was you know, doing away with the borders and the Council on Foreign Relations plan for that. And actually it was funded by the Rockefeller interests, and is called the Council for the Americas, and they're going to a cute little twist here. In 2010, when this all happens, the borders are seamless. They're going to contribute to the improvement of Mexico, and the funds for that are going to, some of them are going to come from that foundation, and the remainder will come from the American taxpayer. But it's interesting that what they're going to do is they're going to tap the $463 billion that is unclaimed in Social Security at 1% a year to do this.
And of course, what people don't really understand is that the Rockefellers are really behind most of this. If you read David Rockefeller's memoirs, you'll find that both of his daughters are Marxists, dedicated Marxists, and firm supporters of Fidel Castro. Now, why would David Rockefeller's daughters be Marxists and supporters of Fidel Castro? Because they understand what communism is all about. It's about an elite group ruling the world. That's why they support Fidel Castro. They don't want to redistribute their money. It's yours they want to redistribute. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I was just saying, commenting on David Rockefeller's memoirs, which it's still available. You can still buy it. It's well worthwhile reading. I remember, of course, he's going to lie about most things, but he does admit that he has $2 and they're both dedicated Marxists. Why would the daughters of the richest man in the United States be Marxist? Now, of course, you probably think it's Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are the richest men in America, but then you probably think a lot of things that aren't true. David Rockefeller, the wealth of the Rockefeller family certainly eclipses that of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett by hundreds of times, but they don't want the American people to know who's really running things. But David Rockefeller, his daughters are dedicated Marxists, and they support Fidel Castro. Why would these girls born into great wealth support Fidel Castro? Because Fidel Castro wants what they want, and that is a ruling elite to control the common folks. Marxism, socialism, is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work without force. Somebody's got to be in charge, and it's going to be people like the daughters of David Rockefeller or David Rockefeller or his associates who are going to be in charge when the corporations come to rule the world. It's a return to a feudalistic system with a ruling elite and everybody else living in poverty and serfdom. They know exactly what's going on. It's amazing that nobody ever tells the American people. Bob, go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, you're right, and I think if for those who do their reading, they will find that communism was financed by internationalist interests out of London, Paris, and the United States, and so you had this dichotomous effect of both sides being controlled by the same group of people. And they have done this since the 12th century. Now, they have never been successful in fully pulling this off. Every time they tried it, they've missed. But they have managed to retain power. And they've done that through their enormous wealth. And so that's why we get this situation of world government recycling all the time, every two or three generations. Because that's the way that they go about it, and they always seem to survive the crises because, quite frankly, no one has the understanding to completely liquidate them. Because if you don't do that, they're just going to do it over and over and over again.
All right. Well, hold on. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and let me just comment briefly. We have a clipping in our files. It was 1992, and David Rockefeller is writing an editorial for the Wall Street Journal, talking about the importance of NAFTA. Now, NAFTA was being put forward in 1992, and he said, you know, we have to get NAFTA through. We've been waiting for this for 500 years. We've been waiting for this for 500 years. What happened 500 years before 1992? Why, 1492, when Columbus came to America. He understands the long-range planning behind this move towards NAFTA and CAFTA and the World Trade Organization and the transfer of American sovereignty to world government, because, of course, David Rockefeller was part of this movement, one of the leaders of this movement. But the betrayal of America, the ultimate in terrorism, changing our form of government from a free society to a fascist society. Well, before we go on, I want you to know how to get in touch with Bob Chapman and get his information, because I will tell you, I look forward to reading it every Sunday when it comes in. In fact, I just printed it out today because I was away yesterday and been reading this avidly before we went on the air. Bob, how can people get in touch with you? How can they get copies of the International Forecaster and really keep abreast of what's going on?
Well, that's pretty simple. All I have to do is call toll-free to 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And we'll send you a complimentary copy, whether it's by email or in hard copy, and then you can see for yourself what we do. And we probably have the best product in the world of its kind, and there's really nothing like it. And if you really want to know what's going on and stay abreast and save yourself from going broke in these markets, you want to read it.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly endorse Bob as an international forecaster. I look forward to it every single weekend. Once you subscribe, you will as well. Well, Bob, you know, some of the things that are going on today, certainly as far as the housing market. Now, one of the things that's been keeping things going here in America has been this housing bubble, which has been created artificially because it's created a tremendous amount of artificial money, tremendous assets, you know, and people are borrowing on their homes and spending, and then as the value of the home goes up, they borrow more and they spend it. But what we've done is we've created an asset bubble with absolutely nothing behind it and no relationship between the value of their homes and reality. I mean, you could, an apartment in the city of New York is over, $1 million, $1,200,000. Dollars, you know, simple homes or $1 million homes in America today. This has nothing to do with any sort of a rational appraisal of true value, does it?
I don't think so, because it's a place for money to go. Money doesn't know what to do. They don't want to go in the stock market. They don't want to go in the bond market. So they run up the real estate market, and that's pretty simple for the average person to get involved in. It's not sophisticated because most people know about homes. Well, that's coming to an end. The tops of the markets are starting to come off, just like they did in England about 14, 15 months ago. And I believe that it's beginning to happen here. I think next year is going to be a very, very difficult year. And the years that follow are going to be absolutely horrible. And that's reality. I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just telling you what I think. And after 46 years, I kind of get a pretty good bead on things. And I certainly have been right, particularly in the last 10 years. And so you people better get out of debt and get yourself in gold and silver-related assets, because if you don't, you're going to be in serious trouble.
Well, now, are we going to have inflation, or are we going to have deflation? And whether prices going to go up, you know, as the government expands the money supply in an effort to keep the whole thing from collapsing, or are we going to have a recession where people quit buying and prices begin falling? And of course, once you get into a deflationary spiral, sometimes you'll end up like they have in China, in Japan, where for 15 years they haven't been able really to get people buying again psychologically. The Japanese are afraid because so many of them worked so hard and accumulated money, and they invested it in property and they invested in stocks, and they simply bottomed out. At one time, Japan had 8 of the 10 largest banks in the world, and today most of their banks are on the verge of bankruptcy simply because of their lending practices that fuel this phenomenal economic spiral in Japan, and then the ultimate collapse. What's going to happen here in the United States? Are we going to go the way of Japan, or are we going to go to runaway inflation?
Runaway inflation first, and they told us that's what they're going to do. If you look at the international forecast, we have all of the increases in credit figures from all sorts of markets, commercial paper, bank loans. It's all there. It's very easy to understand. And all the money supply each week, what it is, the year-to-date, what it is year-on-year, and you can see that the increase in monetary aggregates, and that's what money and credit is, that's what it's called, is increasing at an annualized rate of about 12% right now. And at the same time, they're raising interest rates, which is a very dichotomous situation. In fact, you would think it was very stupid when it's not. What they're doing is they're telling you on one hand, hey, look, we're raising interest rates. On the other hand, they're pouring money into the economy, and they're not going to stop. We are going to have hyperinflation. We're going to see silver over $100. You're going to see gold over $3,000. and it is a lead pipe lock cinch. This is going to be much, much bigger than 1978-80. And the reason why is the debt is preposterous, not only governmentally, but personally. There is no way out. And if you don't get out of real estate now, you're going to be very unhappy later.
All right, Bob. Well, I think that you're absolutely right on your appraisal. We are in some very, very difficult times, and certainly Alan Greenspan has alluded to that, certainly Paul Volcker, and I know you know the article that he wrote back on the 10th of April in the Washington Post talking about how we're skating on thin ice, and that sooner or later, with either a bang or a whimper, why, there's going to be, the time that probably with the financial crisis, because there's no instance in all history where a nation has been able to spend 6% more than it's producing indefinitely. The central banks will stop purchasing our debt, and then the whole thing comes down. And Paul Volcker really knows what's going to happen, in my estimation, because he's part of this whole international central banking cabal, and that's really what it is. The central banks of the world, all privately owned, control the economies of their respective governments, and ultimately then the economy of the world. They meet regularly over at the meetings of the Bank for International Settlement and the group of seven or eight, G7, or I guess it's G8 at the present time. And Paul Volcker is usually at these meetings. He is in with the people who are running banking, and he is talking about a collapse of our economic system. I think that they are intentionally moving us in that direction. I think they want it to collapse. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
I agree with that. And it's the way that they can get people to accept world government. And it's pretty simple. I discovered this in 1967 and 68. And I discovered the tremendous hold that these people have on media. And in the ensuing years, I've seen this move towards world government continue to move. And now what's happened is that I do a lot of research every day, and I'm seeing the same thing that you and I, Stan, have been talking about since the early 1960s about world government and all of those kinds of things are being espoused and talked about by the left, so to speak, or people who have been in that quadrant politically and philosophically over the years. And finally, people are coming together and understanding that we have a common enemy. We're not adversaries of one another, Democrat, Republican, left, right. We are all adversaries against this group of people who are trying to control all of us, take our freedom, our life, everything that we have away from us, and the American public just doesn't seem to be interested.
Well, I think, Bob, that one of the big reasons is because the enemies of freedom have infiltrated the conservative movements in America and the Christian movements in America and even the anti-communist movement in America, and they use the anti-communist, the Christian movement, and the conservative movement to say, oh, we've got to stay beside George Bush. We've got to support what he does because he's a Christian, and after all, if he's a Christian, what he must be doing is good for America. We've always wanted to have a Christian president, and you look and see what's happening. The Christians are supporting this war as if somehow this is a just war. It's all right to torture as long as the Christian president says it's all right. It's all right to capture people and then send them to other countries where they will torture people. And when the president came out and opposed the recent Senate vote, it was 90-9, against torture, and we would no longer have torture, why the Bush administration said, is threatening to veto the legislation, because they say we will determine, of course, how the prisoners are handled. How can the Christian leaders of this country, how can the conservative leaders of this country, how can the anti-communist leaders of this country back an administration that will do that? I'm a lifelong Republican, but I cannot support anything that this administration is doing other than cutting taxes. But you can't cut taxes and increase spending, or you'll destroy the system, and that seems to be exactly what they're intent upon doing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and we're flying headlong toward this thing. And, you know, programs like yours and a handful of others try to get the word out, and we do in print. But, you know, one of the big problems that we're having presently is that the government, via servers, is trying to put people out of business. We've been hacked the last four issues that we've sent out, and fortunately our server is in a foreign country, and so they have a heck of a time trying to do it. But it's perpetual harassment, and there'll come a time when you and I won't be able to go on the air anymore, because what we're saying is anti-American.
What we're saying is pro-American. It is the these people who hate America, who would destroy this country, they're the ones who really hold the reins of power. Their loyalty is not to America, but to this dream of a one-world government under the ruling elite.
Well, that's correct. And I expect what we are doing will become against the law within the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, you may very well be right, Bob, but we should do it as long as God gives us the opportunity. I don't know if in your communities, but I know in the community I live in, communities adjacent to us, they're getting those video cameras up every place. Of course, we're putting them up because why, we want to be protected against the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's living in a cave, or I don't think he's living in a cave at all. I think we know exactly where he's living. I don't think we have ever had an intent of getting Osama bin Laden. We need an enemy to rally the people behind the government. It's the oldest trick in the world, and when are people going to wake up? Well, our telephone number, and we'll take a few calls if you'd like to call in. Before we wrap up this evening's program with Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster, but I will tell you, a fascinating, fascinating newsletter, well worthwhile reading on a weekly basis. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you want to talk to Bob and get his thoughts on anything. But certainly Bob is pointing out that many of the people who spent their whole lives working for corporations, and they think, of course, they're going to get a pension, and suddenly they find out that there will be no pension. A friend of ours works for Northwest Airlines. They've worked there for 27 years. And suddenly they're talking about simply outsourcing his job. And they're doing this increasingly all across America. They're simply outsourcing jobs. Of course, it's almost a little humorous now. They're beginning to outsource legal work, and you can get your legal work and your research done over in India for a fraction of what you can get it done here. Maybe that might get some of the attorney's attention. Well, let's go to Roger, who's been patiently waiting. Hi, Roger. Do you have a quick question for our guest?
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. Yeah, I'd like to ask Bob, you mentioned already, because I heard a couple of days back on the Liars Club radio, some guy pushing and validating the Federal Reserve, and I hope Bush picks a competent replacement for Greenspan, etc. And then you mentioned the 12% inflation, which...
Do you have a question, though? We've got a couple of people on the line.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, what were the real inflation figures for the last couple of years, and what do you see, say, for the next year would have to be to sustain all this debt spending?
Okay, what do you think the inflation rate is, Bob, and what's it going to happen to it?
The figure has been, over the last 5 years, approximately 10% a year, maybe a little bit higher than that. And in the next 2 years, it'll move over 15%. And they have admitted previously to 2 to 3%, so they're going to have to eventually admit to 7 to 8%. But you're never going to get any truth out of them. And the same thing with the employment figures, and almost everything the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out is a lie.
They make up statistics, and when I say make up, that's really what they're doing. All right, thanks very much, Roger. Let's go to George calling from Toronto. Hi, George. How are you doing?
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. First of all, can I ask you, Mr. Chapman, can I access your toll-free number from Canada?
Bob, can
That can be reached from Canada, I think.
And can I receive hard copies of your
sure.
Forecaster? Okay.
Yes.
The question I have, and I'll listen off the air, is can you tell me about the Swiss franc? Is it backed by anything, please? Thank you.
Thank you. And then the question then by George, what about the Swiss franc? Is the Swiss franc a good currency to be affiliated with?
Well, first of all, it used to be approximately 45% backed by gold, and it's my guess it's about 28 to 30% now. Maybe it's a little higher than that because they've been selling gold. And the Swiss have missed the point. They're making the same mistakes now everybody else has. But it is probably the best of a bad lot. And why do I say a bad lot? Because all currencies are in part today, with minor exception, such as the Swiss franc, they are fiat currencies. And that's why gold is broken out against all the currencies. And so gold has reasserted itself is the only real debt-free currency. And that's why gold's going to go through the roof, whether we have inflation or deflation. And I think we're going to have inflation first, followed by deflation.
Hold that thought there, right? Just we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Bob Chapin of the International Forecast. Well, our guest this evening, Bob Chapin, the International Forecaster, and Bob was saying he really believes that the Swiss franc is one of the few currencies that has any gold backing. At one time it was 40-45%, now it seems to be maybe 25-30% gold backing, but at least there are some restraints on them increasing the money supply indefinitely. How are Swiss banks? Are most of them fairly stable?
Now, for the most part, yes. And I think that they have probably been moving back into gold, and they won't talk about that, but I suspect that they are. And they're part of the system, so to speak, that system being the elitist system of control. And, you know, they wouldn't be able to exist unless they were part of that.
And so
that is one of the better currencies. The euro is 15% backed by gold, which is not bad, but it's not good either. And because of the problems that they have, and Switzerland has problems too, economically.
But of course, you were pointing out all the problems that Germany is having. The economy of East Germany has gone into the basket, and Germany has spent, you know, countless billions of dollars trying to incorporate East Germany into West Germany, and the East Germans, of course, they have been under communism so long, they don't really want to work. They want the welfare state to continue.
Well, Eastern Germany is a good example of that. The unemployment there is still, it's around 26% if you do away with all the subsidies. And unemployment in Germany is well over 12%. It's probably around 14, whereas unemployment in the United States is probably, since Rita and Katrina, it's probably moved back up to 13.5% again. See, what the BLS is doing is they're using what they call hedonic figures. And what is that? It's Mickey Mouse bookkeeping. And the figures are what they want them to be. When they tell you it's 5.2%, it has no connection with reality.
And I think it's so vitally important that people understand we're being lied to, that we have people in government who make up statistics. And they make them up, of course, to go along with what they want you to believe. But the truth of the matter is, inflation is not 2 to 3%, as we're told. It's up somewhere, according to Bob, but what, 8 to 10%?
I would say it's 10%.
All right, fine. And all you need to do is look at the prices. Don't believe what the figures are. Look at the prices, ladies and gentlemen, and understand you're being lied to. Our guest this evening has been Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster. Bob, thanks so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you. And we look forward to, in the not-too-distant future, to have you back with us again. Thank you so much, Bob. And I guess but we've lost Bob Chapin, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. We've got Jack on the line. Jack, we lost our guest. We're out of time. Did you have a quick question?
Oh, gosh, Dr. Stan. Well, I did. I wanted to run something by Bob that could possibly free up an awful lot of money regarding people and their mortgages. But I'll try to reach him.
All right, why don't you reach him off the air? God bless. Good to hear from you. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we've gone out on a limb to be on a radio network in the Middle West every afternoon at 3 o'clock on 16 to 17 stations, and our program is heard on stations all across America. Our weekend program, 34, 35 stations now. And, of course, we've lost a couple because somebody goes in and buys up radio stations we're on, and then, of course, they no longer will carry our program. I wonder why that's happening, but it's happening to everybody who's telling the truth. An organized effort to silence the truth here in America, and as incredible as it may seem, it really is happening. In fact, Jimmy Walters, who we had a billionaire, a multi-billionaire who was very concerned about 911, and Jimmy Walters had actually spent millions of dollars on his own running television advertisements in New York City about 911 and the fact that we weren't being told the truth. A full-page ads in the New York Times about that, and they threatened his life. He's living over in Europe at the present time. In seclusion, this is what happens today to people who try to get the truth out. So understand that there really are evil and wicked people. They intend to create a fascist dictatorship in America, but for the time being, they're using America's wealth and America's financial power to bring all countries into the New World Order, the New World Religion. America is the major force behind the drive to world government. And that means that you and I, who are Americans, who love this country, have to be involved, have to be working to try to get the truth out. A lot of people don't want to hear it, but they're going to be willing to hear. As our economy begins to sag, as more and more people lose their jobs, as certainly the hand of tyranny descends upon us, as more and more of the television video cameras go up, in the name, of course, protecting us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who lives in a cave in Pakistan. Well, the truth of the matter is he lives in a home in Iran, but they're not telling us that. But then there's so much they don't tell the American people. A source reference for that would be Ken Timmerman's most recent book, or the book by Congressman Kurt Weldon. Neither one, of course, you're going to hear about. This is the time we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And then we would simply remind you we are having an all-day session here in the Monterey Bay area on the 19th of November, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to coming. If you're going to come on the 19th of November, an all-day session, that's a Saturday, why, you're going to have to call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and make a reservation, because, of course, we have to know if you're going to come, because we're going to be serving lunch. And then we ask you to certainly tell others, encourage them to come. And as I said earlier, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Still, if you will not fight for the right, when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when your victory will be sure and not too costly, you may come to the moment when you will have to fight with all odds against you and only a perilous chance for survival. Or there may be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope for victory, for it would be better to perish than to live as slaves. Well, those words were spoken by Winston Churchill, and he's right. But our battle has to be with ideas. Our battle has to be with tracks, with radio programs like this. Won't you join us in this battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization?